Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Delighted to have Ellen Brown back. Ellen, of course, wrote the vital book, Web of Debt, the brilliant analysis of the private banking system, how it usurps money creation power, and how we can get it back. And she also heads the Public Banking Institute. It's an initiative to do what's long overdue, to return power to the people where it belongs. And Ellen, if you'll allow me, you may want to comment on this. Well, you're the one who's the maestro of this event. In the city of brotherly love, on April 27 and 28, my goodness, in my past life, I went to school there and worked there for a short time. It feels like my past life because I went to school there in the 1950s. My goodness, I mean, Eisenhower was still president at the time. We don't even have a Democrat anywhere near close to what he was. He was no saint. But, oh, my goodness, we sure would love to have him back compared to the choices we have now. Anyway, April 27 and 28, in the city of brotherly love, the Public Banking Institute is holding, I'm reading from your website, Ellen, is holding the inaugural Public Banking in America conference. In response for growing demand for monetary and banking reform in the public interest, I guess it comes down to, Ellen, do we want to control our own lives, or do we want to let Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, the other giant banks we've grown to love, and beat up on all the time, which is what I spend a lot of my time doing, and you too, do we want to let them run our lives? Or do we want to run our lives ourselves? It literally comes down to that choice. It's an easy one. Ellen, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Stephen. Great to talk to you, as always.
Is everything on track for the end of the month?
As far as I know, yeah. You say I'm the maestro, but in fact, I feel like I'm at the head of this engine that's pushing me from behind.
Oh, you are the inspiration. You're the one doing this. You head up the Public Banking Institute. I just can't imagine a more important initiative. I really mean that, because the power of money literally controls everything. If you or I control the power of money, if we were the personification of what Wall Street is today, if we control the power of money, we could shut it off to the war machine, and those imperial wars would end, provided they couldn't kill us and take the power back. But assuming they couldn't do that, big assumption, we literally could shut down their war machine. We could shut down all the other nefarious things that they do. Without money, they can't operate. You can't drive your car without gasoline. You can't turn on the lights at home unless you pay your electric bill. You know, it goes on and on like that. I mean, we literally control everything. And, you know, in your book, you quoted the Rothschilds, and I did in mine as well, and in a couple of articles. You know, give me the power of money. I don't give a damn what else you do. It doesn't mean a thing. I mean, we'll decide what's going to happen that's of importance. And if we disagree with you, that's tough. We win, you lose. That's why it's important. I mean, public banking, it's long overdue for public banking, Ellen. And your article, your latest article, just a work. Oh, do you want to talk about that? It's a work in progress. You haven't published it yet.
Sure, because it seems important to me. It's on the European Stabilization Mechanism.
Oh, indeed. Let's do this. Let's talk very briefly about the conference at the end of the month, because I think listeners would want to know about it. Some of them might want to come.
Okay. The conference is the 27th and 28th with a welcome dinner or welcome event of some sort, Thursday night, the 26th. It's held at the Friends Center, which is the Quaker Center, where, interestingly, the first public, well, I shouldn't say the first, there was a public land bank established in Philadelphia, which was the best of the public banking models of the colonial America, or the American colonists, and that was the model that we're following today. The land bank was set up as a way to get money out into the economy. There were two ways that the colonists got issued money. One was either to just print it. You know, they didn't have gold, and they lacked a money supply, and so trade was down until and they weren't able to fund their local wars and so forth until they originated this method of just issuing money. They weren't allowed to issue money that their overlords didn't allow them to literally issue money. So what they were issuing were bills of credit, but they traded as money. It really was paper money. So there were two ways that they got it out there. One was to just print and spend the money and then tax it back. But the colonists didn't like taxes, and they weren't very good about taxing it back. You know, they tended to just, especially the northern colonies, tended to just print and spend, which did hyperinflate or devalue the value of the currency. So the other way, which was much more sound, was to print and lend the money. So they lent it to the farmers, and then they lent it at a better interest rate than they could get from the British bankers. And there really weren't any, there were very few British bankers around. I mean, you just couldn't get money at all. So they lent this money at 5% interest. It would come back to the government, and then they could spend a little extra, print and spend some extra. So there was enough money out there to pay principal and interest to make the whole system sustainable. So say you would print 105, lend 100, spend 5, there'd be 105 out there. It would all come back to pay principal and interest. Then you could lend the same 100, spend the same 5, and it would all come back. So you never have to increase the money supply in order to pay principal and interest, unlike today where the interest isn't created by the banks. And so somebody somewhere has to take out another loan to cover that interest. So what you have is this pyramid scheme that keeps spiraling us deeper and deeper into debt. So that was a very sustainable system, but the Pennsylvanians had the best of these systems. It lasted the longest. It was the most sustainable. I mean, it was the value, the currency did not devalue. They paid no taxes at all except excise taxes on liquor, and they had no debt. So it was an excellent model, and this was largely because of the Quakers who founded Pennsylvania. William Penn was a Quaker and took his Quaker followers to, they were persecuted in England and they needed a place of their own, and he was granted this large, he was granted all of Pennsylvania in return for a debt owed to his father by the king. And he was a very honest man and set up this very democratic system, and they had been bankers in England because they were discriminated against, just like the Jews were. They weren't allowed to go into any kind of business they weren't allowed to go into regular businesses, and so they went into banking. But they were very honest, equitable bankers, and they had a reputation for that. So the model they set up in the U.S. was very, they already had sound banking practices. They didn't make loans except to people that were going to pay them back. You know, they didn't, some of the other colonies did, they had land banks, but they just didn't operate them as well. They didn't operate them on as sound a banking principle. So anyway, the Quakers were instrumental in this whole model, and it was in Philadelphia, which is also the home, obviously, of independence, the Constitution, and, you know, our basic democratic values. It was also the home of this excellent public banking model that we're trying to duplicate today.
Oh, it sounds wonderful, and I would just say that I know roughly where the conference is being held. I'm not personally familiar with the Friends Center, not even certain if it was there in the 1950s. It may have been, but the conference is located at 1501 Cherry Street in downtown Philadelphia. From my boarding house in the 1950s, it's probably long gone, Ellen, I could have walked downtown. It would have taken me... Oh, it was 2 or 3 miles from my location, University of Pennsylvania. But, an easy walk. I could have done that very easily. In fact, if I were in Philadelphia and was attending, I would walk. I could take a bus, but I probably would just walk downtown and go right to the Cherry Center. If the weather was nice, if the weather was awful, then I'd want to get a bus or something. But very simple to get to, a central location, and... Anybody?
And we have a lot of good speakers, a lot of really good speakers.
Two full days of speakers and discussions. Want to mention a couple of names?
Yeah. I invited you, but you can't travel.
travel is like the easiest thing
for
me. Oh, I know you did, Ellen. I'm so grateful that you did that. I honestly hope that I will participate with you one of these days. Please forgive me for not being with you in Philadelphia.
Oh, no, totally understood. I have that problem myself. I'm half crippled, but I keep dragging around.
You're half fixed.
Then the other side is sort of broken down, but I'm going to get that one fixed too.
You
got
to get that one fixed too. Oh boy, yeah. Go through it a second time. Wow. fixing a joint. Yeah. Well, I guess you're going in for surgery. Always is nasty. By the way, how is your mother doing?
Well, I'm not sure. I called over there and they wouldn't tell me because I have to speak to the doctor and I couldn't reach the doctor. So I'll do that after.
Oh,
this.
I do hope she's okay. This came up last night.
Yeah, she fell. She's fallen before.
Oh,
she's 92.
My goodness.
So, yeah.
Oh. Well, another problem with, I mean, at my age, I think about things like this. I get up slowly. I mean, I'm not immobile. I just can't stand around very long or walk around very long, but I'm not immobile. But I'm very conscious that the bones maybe get a little weaker as you get older, men like women. So I get up slowly. I don't jump up the way I did many years ago. And I take things as smoothly as I can. I'm not looking for trouble, and I hope it doesn't find me.
Yeah, I know. I shouldn't talk about all that, but yeah, my mother's very careful too. But she's 92, and she broke her hip last fall, and so one leg is already shorter than the other. So she's just unbalanced, and you can't just like strap her into a chair, you have to allow her to move around because that's her life. They had her strapped in a chair and it. In a board and care, and she just was very unhappy there. So.
Oh, I would be miserable. And at my age, I mean, this summer I'll turn 78. So, I mean, I hope I'll be around when I'm 92. My mother was for another year or so. And, I hope I'll still be hosting this program at age 92. Maybe even beyond. I was on a few years ago. And I've met the check. I haven't done it. I'm going to have to do it. I was interviewed by a radio host who literally was doing media work before I was born. His name was George Putnam in Los Angeles, as a matter of fact. Does that name ring a bell, Ellen?
Sort of.
I mean, he was in his 90s then, I think early 90s, and that was a few years ago. I think around 4 years ago, he spotted an article that I wrote, and he liked it, and he got his producer to get me on air, and I believe his views are ideologically different from mine. He's on the right, but he liked what I wrote about, and he wanted me on. And if I didn't know his age, I never could have imagined it. He was absolutely lucid. I mean, he sounded like he could have been 40 instead of in his 90s. Well, let's say he was 92 or so then, he'd probably be about 96 now. Well, I mean,
I was just in Canada over the Canadian budget. That's another thing we could talk about. And at the invitation of Paul Hellyer, who is 88. And he is just as sharp as a tack. He was the former defense minister, but he founded a money reform group or a political party that had monetary reform as one of its basic platforms, the Canadian Action Party. And also Bill Krem, I spoke at CUMR, which is the Committee for Monetary Reform in Canada. And their founder must be close to 100, and he's still putting out a journal that's, you know, quite good.
Well, that's amazing.
It is amazing.
I had two memorable professors when I was back in college, Ellen. The others, I mean, I had a lot of distinguished ones, but there were only two that I really, if they were living, I would love to get them on this program. And one of them, his field was, I believe, microbiology or something related to it. And he was a Nobel Prize recipient in his field years later. George Wald was his name. But he was ideologically very, very much like us, Ellen. And the other one was a man named Sam Beer. And I'm not entirely sure what his ideology was, but I do know that he lived in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, and he deplored fascism. He saw it up close and personal, and he absolutely deplored it. It never came out in his classes. He had the most popular class on campus, bar none. It was a social science course, and he was a very, very dramatic figure. He lived to around age 97, and he was still living when I was hosting, and his obituary said, or one of them, that he was lucid to the end. I just can't imagine what a glorious experience that would have been for me. I had him, I was in his class as a freshman, around 18 years old or so. I mean, he just bowled me over with his presence. And to end up having him on my own program, if I only knew that and bothered to check, and if the university would give me contact so I could get hold of him, I'll bet he would have come on if I told him that in 1952 I was one of his students. How could he turn me down? I once tried to get Walter Cronkite on this program, Ellen, and he was in his 90s, and I managed to talk to CBS, gave him an office, and he kept it right up to the end, and I spoke to one of the people in his office, and they said to me very apologetically that at his advanced age, he just decided that he didn't want to do any more interviews. He wanted to go sailing. Well, I couldn't blame him. But he would have been a very interesting guest as well. Not that he was perfect.
Or like you do, you know, you stay home. You don't have to travel to do talking. And
that's
Hazel
exactly
Henderson
right.
Actually does, she does Skype interviews, so you can see her, but she didn't travel. She's actually going to do an interview or a presentation at our conference, but it'll be a Skype.
who'll be doing that?
Hazel Henderson. She's a... I'm not sure how old she is, but her husband that's so sickly, so she doesn't leave him. He had some sort of heart condition.
Does she live in America?
She's British. Lives in she still has a bit of a British accent, but lives in America, and she's an economist and has done some really interesting things with the GDP and showing that that we don't do the GDP right. In other words, we only count sales. So you include things like sales of weapons, and you know, they're quite destructive things. And we leave out the quality of life things that are the goods that, you know, that we value in society.
Well, indeed, those are important. By the way, I just looked up George Putnam. I found him. He died on September 12th, 2008, born in 1914. If he were alive, he would be born July 14th. Well, this July 14th, he would have turned 98. Would have turned 90. Right. So he was around 94, still hosting radio, when he had me on. And on the Wikipedia site, they have an image of him in 1965. Well, of course, he looked a lot younger than he did when he had me on. But... my goodness, a loss,
yeah.
A loss.
I'll say one other thing about Philadelphia. The Occupy, Philadelphia Occupy group, the Occupy Philly General Assembly decided in April to hold a national gathering in Philadelphia in July. So I don't know if anything will come of that. I mean, the occupiers are... sort of intentionally leaderless and platformless because they don't want to get narrowed down to where they, you know, get shot down, and they don't want any leader that gets literally shot down. But anyway, there's action here. There's hope of reviving the whole revolutionary fever that came out of Philadelphia a couple hundred years ago.
I think it's crucial to do it, Ellen. And the weather, it's not easy getting a lot of people out during the colder winter months, although this winter, at least in Chicago, was one of the mildest of all, and literally in March, for half of the month, we had June in March. It was absolutely incredible. It was surreal.
Well, this will be in July, the Occupiers.
The Occupiers, yeah.
And then ours is the end of April, so that's not too cold.
Oh, there's a gap between them. I understand the rationale of wanting to be leaderless. leaders get singled out, you know, just like on the African plains, the beasts that need food to eat will single out, it's sort of a reverse analogy, single out a weaker target that they can take down easily, that's the ideal, or something small and manageable, but they try to isolate one if there's a herd, and then go after the individual. You know, it's a lot harder attacking a herd. Well, in this case, instead of the weak one, it would be the strong one, but strong ones sometimes are targeted, and Occupy Wall Street absolutely is being targeted in every city where they hold demonstrations. The local cops are in cahoots with the state cops, in cahoots with the Department of Homeland Security. If there's one of the open secrets on the imperial side, on the police state side, it's that. This is a federal, you know, Obama sides himself with the Occupy movement. My foot. His foot is coming down hard on them. All he has to do is call off Homeland Security. Instead, they're colluding with each other, and we know how the cops have beaten up and arrested and harassed the daylights out of these people. But they've been courageous, and now we're up to mid-April.
Yeah, so I think it's good that they even just have an energy still going. I mean, that's what you want, is that grassroots energy. And then hopefully we can shape it, turn it to some something that's legal. That, you know, we don't want to start bloodshed, but I think the whole public banking movement is a good option. We can one thing we'll be arguing for at this conference is to set up county-owned land banks, which would take over these blighted and foreclosed and abandoned properties that have no owner, you know, that the county title records are so messed up that nobody can prove ownership. And so the county could just move in and say, we're taking that by eminent domain. If anybody can prove title, we'll compensate you, because nobody's going to be able to prove title. And then they'll get all these free properties, and then they could restore them. They could use that as a base for their county bank, put their revenues in the bank, do like all banks do, which is duplicate their money in the form of credit. That's the key thing that we have to get over to people, is that banks do not lend their depositors money. They do not lend their own money. They create money on their books. So they basically double their money. They create money equal to their deposits less 10% if there's a 10% reserve requirement. That's in theory, but in fact, they create all the money they want. And if they don't have the deposits, they borrow the deposits from somewhere else, from some other bank or from the money market or from CDs. So the state or the county or whoever sets up this bank can put their revenues in the bank. The revenues are still there. They are not spending those deposits. They're not spending their money. They're creating credit equal to that money, which then can be used for many purposes, public projects of different sorts, or you can use it the way an ordinary bank does, make loans for, I mean, what North Dakota does is they partner with the local banks, and then the local bank deals with the customers, which would be, you know, homeowners and small business, agriculture, et cetera, particularly things that the Bank of North Dakota wants to promote, and then they help with capital requirements and liquidity requirements. But the point is, you're doubling your money. So by putting your deposits in Wall Street and investing your capital in Wall Street, you're allowing them to double their money and use it against us. Whereas if you put it in your own bank, you get that credit power yourself, and you can use it for the local economy.
And just the fact of public banking, Ellen, the word public means public. They are serving the public. They're not self-serving. You give it to the big banks, the giant banks, the Wall Street banks, the banks affiliated with them, working hand in glove, however they do it. They use your money. They speculate with it. They work against you. They put their own people in charge in top government positions. And you wrote in your latest article, you wrote how Goldman Sachs co-opted Europe what a good segue into this article, Ellen. And you call it, it's still a work in progress, maybe you'll change the title, but you call it the European Stabilization Mechanism, or how the Goldman Vampire Squid just captured Europe. Well, I would say they stole it, Ellen.
Yeah.
They make money the old-fashioned way, you know. They steal it. That's how they make money. Public banks don't do that, but the Goldman Sachs banks of the world do it. Talk about your article.
Well, when Henry Paulson did it, you know, I mean, he succeeded in getting a bailout, but it was a one-time bailout. It was $700 billion, and he had, you know, it was like pulling teeth. He had to drop to his knees and say that he was they'd have to impose martial law and that the whole global economy was about to collapse. So it was a big deal, and it was in the news, and everybody argued about it. But they just did it in, and that was just temporary. I mean, he only got the $700 billion, and then they didn't allow that TARP money to go on forever. Of course, then the Federal Reserve stepped in and did this sort of virtually free money for the banks, lent them free money. The TARP money was money they gave them. I mean, the $700 billion bailout was taxpayer money that was actually handed over, whereas the money that Ben Bernanke gave the banks was just basically credit. I mean, they just wrote it up into an account and basically let the banks borrow against the Federal Reserve's credit instead of against the money market and all those other places that they used to borrow where credit had frozen. But still, that Ben Bernanke made this very cheap credit available without even no discussion. You know, that's the nature of an independent central bank. So then Mario Draghi, I guess that's how you pronounce it, who was also a CEO, or I guess he was a vice president of Goldman Sachs Europe, just as Henry Paulson was CEO of Goldman Sachs in Wall Street, U.S., Mario Draghi was appointed head of the European Central Bank. So he did the same thing that Ben Bernanke did, made all this money, cheap money available to the banks. Meanwhile, you have the, he was appointed last fall, and I think he made that money available in December. And then in January, they came up with this thing called the European Stabilization Mechanism, which there was no argument about at all. I mean, it just passed quietly in the middle of the night, and it's basically the governments, the EU governments have agreed to put up as much money as necessary to pay off the creditors. Well, the creditors of the EU member banks when this fund is tapped up. Well, the creditors are, of course, largely the banks. So they're bailing out the banks, and it's open-ended, and it's the governments themselves. In other words, the taxpayers are going to have to put up the money. It's not just credit created on the books of the central bank, which is how they actually should do it. But instead, they've committed to debt slavery. I mean, all these countries have committed to put up the money for whatever the creditors demand. So it's a horrible thing, and there's hardly any discussion about it, and that's why I thought I'd better write about it. When I heard about it, I mean, it seems like we need to know these things, that they all just kind of happen quietly, and everybody accepts it and says, oh, great, now we don't have to worry about Greece defaulting or whatever. So the creditors are all happy, the market's happy, the governments are happy, but what have they just done? They've just committed themselves to a gigantic, unending debt.
Indeed, Ellen. Hold that thought, and let's take a break and come back. Indeed, it's a great scam. We'll come right back. Thank you. Welcome back on with Ellen Brown, talking about the Public Banking Institute, Ellen's book, Web of Debt, always at the top of the program. The Public Banking Conference, 27, 28 February, April, in Philadelphia, and Ellen's new article on how Goldman Sachs captures Europe. Ellen, there was a report on Russia today. It was a report that covered a number of things. Within the report, they mentioned that there is still outstanding debt in Britain from World War One. So, you know, the government takes out the loans, bonds, whatever they did back then. And people are literally paying for that today. You know, they pay through their taxes. So today, across Europe and in America, just unbelievable debts have been rung up. They continue to be rung up. I mean, money printing has gone on with abandon. And how many more billions, trillions will they add on to this? How much longer will this scam go on? I mean, maybe 100 years from today, people will still be paying for this.
Mm-hmm. And it's all interest. That's the thing. The French have paid as much in interest since, I think it was something in the 1970s, as their current debt is. So if they had been borrowing from their own central bank all along, they would have had interest free, or because they own the bank, they could keep the interest. They would have no debt today. The Canadians have paid twice as much in interest since, I think, 1961. As their current debt is. So they would not only be debt-free if they were borrowing from their own central bank, they would have lots of extra money. And in fact, the Canadians are a prime example, and I think they might be the leaders out of this morass, because they actually did borrow from their own central bank from 1939 to 1974, 35 years. The debt remained quite level. It did not go up. It was very low and level. Did not go up. They borrowed, the bank just created the money as national credit. This national credit was spent for many things, seaways, roadways, all kinds of development, and it funded much of their participation in World War II, and it funded their excellent healthcare system. The healthcare system isn't as good now as it once was, because lately they've been slashing services in order to allegedly try to pay off some of this debt and balance the budget. But they wouldn't have had this debt at all had they kept up what they were doing right up until 1974. So then you may ask, what changed in 1974? They joined the Bank for International Settlements, and the Group of Six, which became the Group of Seven when they joined, and then, you know, later it was the Group of 10, and then the Group of 20, and that's the group that sets the standards for banking. And so the goal of the Basel Committee, supposedly, was to maintain a stable currency, which meant you can't increase the currency. So you can't print money. Government can't print money, and the government can't borrow from its own central bank, which would increase the money supply. But we know that borrowing from private banks works the same way. Either way, you're increasing the money supply. So governments have been shut off from issuing their own money and being sovereign over their own credit and debt and money. And now the banks have become sovereign over all that, because the governments are not allowed to do it. The ECB under Mario Draghi is lending at the banks at 1%, which is a very low interest rate relative to what the governments are paying. The governments are paying, I think Greece is paying 18%. At 18%, you double your debt in 4 years. The Italians and the Irish, and they're paying somewhere 7 or 8%, very high interest rates. So the obvious solution would be to allow these governments to borrow directly from the ECB at 1%. But no, there's a provision in the Lisbon Treaty, Article 123 of the Lisbon Treaty, says that the ECB is not there to lend to governments. It's there to lend to banks. So the banks get the perks, and the ECB, where does the ECB get the money? They're just creating it on their books in the very same way that the Fed does. It's quantitative easing. but only the banks get these perks. And the theory is that the banks will then turn around and lend to governments or lend to creditors. But there's no rule that they do that. I mean, they can do whatever they want with that cheap money, and what they're more likely to do, and certainly what they've done in the U.S., is just turn around and do this whole carry trade thing where they get money. In the U.S., they get it for 0.25%, and then they turn around and buy bonds for 2%, and they've got free money. I mean, they can't lose on that deal because, nobody's more secure than the government, no matter what you might say about government. Those government bonds are not going anywhere. So you've got your guaranteed 2%, the complement of the American taxpayers. We're the ones paying the interest on that.
And Draghi did what his predecessor, Jean-Claude Trichet, would not do. I mean, Draghi, a.k.a. Goldman Sachs, I mean, he broke the ECB rules. He just lavished billions of dollars on banks. And if they need more, he'll give them more. Same thing as the Fed is doing, and the ECB operates under different rules. Well, you know, who cares about rules? When you're the head of the ECB, you make the rules. I'm sorry, Goldman Sachs makes the rules.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting. I didn't peer into how that switch was made from Trichet to Draghi. Did Trichet just voluntarily get tired and quit, or was he nudged off? And who decided?
Just like Berlusconi, Prime Minister Berlusconi in Italy, Helen, the Prime Minister of Italy didn't wait for an election to come along. I mean, Goldman Sachs literally sacked him and replaced him with another one of its alumni and a former, if I remember right, vice president of the ECB, Papandemos, I forget his first name, but Goldman Sachs again running Greece, Goldman Sachs running Italy, Goldman Sachs running the ECB. Jeez, my God, I'm surprised they're not in our bedroom.
Uh-huh.
If you lived in Europe, they probably would be.
Yeah, and that's why we have to write, because it's just so subtle how they do it. You just would never see it. It's not in the news. It's not obvious. I mean, you can it's there, but you have to track it down. The implications are not there. That's why we have to beat them over the head with this stuff. Look what just happened.
It's a sick system, Ellen. It's absolutely a sick system. My guest tomorrow, and we'll talk about it on the program, John McMurtry, he wrote a book about this. It's a cancer system. It literally is eating us alive, slowly killing us over time. And he wrote a book called The Cancer Stage of Capitalism. And I believe he's got an updated version coming, and he sent me some advanced material on it. I quoted from it in one of my articles, and he actually let me endorse the book. I wrote an endorsement. It was a little bit on the long side, and his publisher cut it down because other people are endorsing as well, and I understand space problems. But it was a first for me, Ellen, a great honor to be able to be one of the people endorsing a book by a man of this esteem, and he's a long-time, very distinguished guy. He'll be on the program tomorrow. We'll talk about this and the greater world issues that's on his mind. But he refers to the kind of system we live under the Fed, under the ECB, you know, the Western system of predatory capitalism. He gives it the right name. He calls it a cancer system. It's killing us.
Yeah, well, that's literally true in mathematical terms, because the profits are being siphoned out. Margaret Kennedy showed that most people think there's this sort of illusion that we're all debtors and we're all creditors. You know, everybody makes a little money off of interest from their money they put in the bank, and then everybody pays a little interest when they take out a loan. But in fact, she showed that 10% of people are net creditors. 80% are net debtors, and then 10% are half and half. So that 10%, which we know is actually the 1% and the 0.1%, I mean, the pyramid gets more and more pointy up toward the top. They're just sucking profits out of the system. And if you look at a graph of the growth of the financial sector over the last 40 or 50 years, I mean, it's just, that's the exponential part. It's just growing hugely, and that's the part that's just sucking the money out of from everyone else. There's a sort of another rumor or whatever, or there's a theory that whenever I say that, banks create the principal, but they don't create the interest, then the response is always, well, they, you know, bankers spend their money too. They spend their profits back into the system. They buy stuff. But they don't. What they do is they reinvest their money. They've got way more money than they could spend on consumables. So they reinvest it in more money-making money projects, which is just this parasitic growth that by definition can't work. You know, there's not enough, the numbers aren't there. We don't live on an exponentially growing planet. We live on a planet that grows linearly, and these numbers are going exponentially, so that just doesn't work.
It really is sick, Gillen. And as far as debt entrapment goes, it starts with people very, very young. Kids have credit cards. They start accumulating charges on it. The most foolish thing in the world to do. I mean, literally, we have a society where banks can borrow at 1% or less, basically free money. But if you have a credit card and the big banks run the credit card systems, the big names, and I mean, I don't know what they charge, 18%, 20%, and if you let it add up, the compounding absolutely kills you. And if you go to school, it's not like when I went to school in the 1950s. I didn't need a loan to get through college. Grad school, I needed a very tiny loan. If I remember the precise amount, it was roughly about $200. $200.
Uh-huh.
I mean, even at much lower pay scales back when I got out in 1960, and it was a different world pay-wise in all ways back then, I easily got rid of that debt. It wasn't onerous. There were no onerous interest rates piling on. I got rid of it my first year very comfortably. I was debt-free. But student loans today literally amount to grand theft, and it's the compounding interest over time that kills these kids. Some of them get debt entrapped. A good many of them get debt entrapped either for many, many years or for life, and they cannot get out of this debt. It's the worst debt to get into. You can't get out of it. They can garnish your wages. They can take your pension. They can take your Social Security. They can probably take anything you have.
Yeah, and I just went to a conference in Claremont that where it was kind of more of a think tank. It was quite small, where we were just discussing among ourselves how we're going to work out the details of all this. And there is this problem of growth that, it seems to me that the problem is it's not really just the bankers. Everybody thinks that our money has to make money. I mean, we don't get enough money to provide for old age. We don't earn enough money to cover for medical emergencies, et cetera, or in education. So all that stuff has to be set aside. So you expect your money to be growing over the 40 years of your working life. You expect it to grow so that by the time you retire, you'll have this pot of money you can spend, or that your investments will support you after you can no longer work. But that expectation is unsustainable. And the only way we can get rid of that expectation is to do like the Swedes and the Norwegians, where they're paying 50% in taxes, although we actually pay 42%. I saw if you count the hidden taxes, they're paying 50% in taxes, but they've got old age, education, and health care covered. So they don't have to worry about those emergency things. So they're very laid back. I've been to Sweden, and, you know, their lifestyle is just so much different from ours. They have time to go boating, you know, to kind of relax, and their houses look kind of the same. There's not all this competition to have a bigger and better house and a bigger, better car and all that. So the emphasis is on other things because they've got security. That's somehow we have to write into the system security. And it's not because people will say, well, we can't afford it. But I'm quite sure, I would love to see the computer models, but it seems to me that it's got to be less expensive to pay for people's old age, health care, and education collectively than for everybody to try to pay for it individually and go horribly into debt like they're doing. Well, look at the GI Bill, for example, where we paid for tuition or for education for returning GIs. And these are a huge number of returning GIs. And that paid for itself seven times over the years, because all those people got better jobs and then they paid more taxes.
It was one of the greatest investments the country ever made, and there was housing assistance back then, too. America's military, World War II, America's military was huge, about 12 million in the military. I mean, just, well, of course, a World War. So we had, my family was in World War II. My dad was in World War I. No GI Bill from World War I. But World War II, I mean, it really was incredible. An incredible investment. It really proves, and there's a great man who's not alive, and if he were, I'd absolutely want him on this program, Seymour Melman. He wrote book after book after book proving that buck for buck put into the private sector for economic growth gets you far more bang for the buck than the same amount of money going for militarism. It simply doesn't register the same game. And part of the scheme is that, you know, we have to keep spending on the military because, I mean, that was the idea after World War II. If they didn't spend enough, we'd fall back into a depression. Well, we didn't fall back into a depression. And if they just put that money into private economic growth, that's the way you create prosperity. You don't do it by waging wars, sending people off to combat, destroying things. It just doesn't work the same way. But we've never had anybody leading this country who feels that way, because America just literally lurched from one war to another, starting with Harry Truman, and it never ended.
Well, but I've written on that, too, that I think the reason is that the only thing that Congress will approve unlimited expenditures for is emergencies, the emergency of war, because theoretically we're a capitalist country and we don't believe in government going into business. So the only businesses we allow the government to go into are the military, because this is an emergency and we need the military. But so just switch it over to a civil service of some sort. You can put the same amount of money out there, and like you say, it's going to be far more productive and far less harmful.
Well, we did it in the 1930s during the Depression, Ellen. And it literally, you know, it didn't end the Great Depression because enough wasn't spent. It could have.
Yeah.
If instead of spending what they did, they spent two or three times that much, it would have ended the Depression, because things got better when the Roosevelt administration started creating jobs, putting people to work, doing public works, building. In Chicago alone, I believe the entire Chicago lakefront, or at least the major portion of it, came out of the New Deal. And there were all kinds of other projects in Chicago alone. Hoover Dam was built, all kinds of things, roads, bridges. I mean, the unemployment rate went from something like 25% down to about 11% because people had jobs. Then we went back into the soup again because they simply cut the faucet off too soon. Things went down again. But the way to create prosperity, if the private sector isn't doing it, that's where government has to step in. And that's what Keynesianism was all about.
Mm-hmm. But I think the difference was that Roosevelt had a blank check. I mean, the Congress actually supported what he was doing.
Oh, they
and
sure did.
It's the same as Lula in Brazil. When he came into office in 2001, I was just reading about his banking system, or what they did with the public bank. It was the BNDES, which is a big development bank. They hugely expanded the credit that was issued by this bank and used it to develop everything in sight. So Lula turned the economy around from being the world's biggest debtor to, by the time he, you know, like 10 years later, he was lending to the IMF, which he thought was really funny that they were lending to the IMF. So how did they do it? But he had the total consent of Congress, or his parliament, or whatever, I suppose it's Congress. Anyway, he was able to do whatever he wanted to do, whereas in the U.S., it seems to me the whole point of both parties is to bring down the other party. I mean, they absolutely do not want anything to get accomplished in Congress. So I don't know how we ever, I mean, to me that's the big hurdle, is how do we get around this big political machine that's blocking us at every turn. But
that's a major problem, Ellen. To me it starts by refusing to vote for anybody who's a Democrat or a Republican, because bipartisan complicity is in this game. The only difference is the rhetoric and the fact that we have an election coming up in November, and the Republicans, of course, always are a Johnny One Note, slash, 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 and they make no bones about it. Obama is a little bit more, he goes along, but he's more circumspect. So they're willing to slash and burn, but they want to save most of it until after the November elections. Just wait and see what happens after that. The Obama rhetoric will change. Oh, we had to do it. We had to save the economy. It means we shared sacrifice, you know. That's one of Obama's lines. I mean, it's going to come out full force. I mean, he's already agreed over the next decade to cut at least $4 trillion. And in the next 10 years, you can bet that number is going to go up exponentially. And what are they cutting? Vital domestic programs, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, essential stuff that needy people need. And what are they increasing?
Backwards. They're doing it totally backwards.
They're doing it backwards. The military budget is going up, Ellen. Except they're going to make the soldiers, when they get out with loss of limbs and whatever else they come home with, they're going to make them pay more for their medical coverage.
Yeah.
Go over and get your head blown off and come back. Oh, I'm sorry. We're broke. We can't give you the health care we promised. We'll give you something, but you have to pay for it. That's the deal. It's not a contract, but that's the deal. That's the way America is run. Anybody voting Republican or Democrat should be ashamed of themselves. Ashamed. Stay home. Vote independent. But don't vote Republican or Democrat. They will screw you. They've been doing it for years.
And how they managed to pull off this bill where everybody is forced to pay for health insurance. I mean, even the young people who don't need it, you have no choice in getting health insurance. I mean, it's so obviously cheaper to have single payer. What happened to single payer?
Oh, single payer is so much cheaper. What do you cut out? You cut out the middleman. The middleman doesn't provide health insurance.
But the middleman has the big lobbies. That's the problem.
We're out of time, Ellen. But when you get sick, you don't go to your insurance agent. You go to your doctor. You don't need an insurance agent. You need a doctor.
Right.
You need a hospital.
Right.
If you want to use those toxic drugs, you need a pharmacist. An insurance company isn't going to give you any treatment. All they'll do is say, oh, I'm sorry. We won't cover you for that. That's the way the system works. Ellen, we're out of time. Do me one favor. Say hello to your mother for me. Wish her my best, and I hope there's nothing serious. I hope she's back in good shape very, very soon.
Okay, thank you so much, and good to talk to you.
Oh, I look forward to next month. I'll shoot you an email about it.
Okay, great.
Join us tomorrow. Same time, John McMurtry. Make it a regular habit.